This is the Skin Science Podcast. I'm Dr. Thomas Hitchcock, and here we'll investigate everything skin science and dissect it from a scientific perspective, analyze it from a medical perspective, critique it from a consumer perspective, and give insight from an industry perspective. Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Thomas Hitchcock, and welcome to the Skin Science Podcast. And with us in the studio, as always, is Angela Wilson-McDonald. How are you doing, Angela?
I'm great. Glad to be here, as always.
You awake, alert, alive?
Of course. We have one of my favorite physicians in the room, so I'm excited to be here.
Well, then why don't you introduce this time, since she's one of your favorite physicians, and read the handwriting part. I would love to.
We're honored today to have Dr. Jennifer Holman, who received her Doctor of Medicine from the University of Oklahoma College of Medicine in 2004, graduating with special academic distinction. During her residency in the Department of Dermatology at the University of Missouri, she was awarded a Women's Dermatologic Society Mentorship Grant to work with the Pediatric Dermatology Department at Northwestern University in Chicago. She is one of the founding partners of U.S. Dermatology. That's how we know her well, and currently serves as regional president. She is board certified in both dermatology and in dermatologic micrographic surgery. So if you missed our previous podcast, please take a listen to that. Some very interesting information in what she does every day. Beyond the work that she does cosmetically in the cosmetic and laser practice in Tyler, Texas since 2018. And the name of that practice is Center for Aesthetic and Laser Medicine. The shortened version of that is CALM in Tyler, Texas. So we are thrilled to have you with us today, Dr. Holman.
Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, before we get started, I think you now know that we're going to have to talk about a puzzle.
But I don't have to do it.
You don't have to do the
puzzle.
I'm
totally fine with that.
But this one is actually super easy, so you can probably figure it out in less than a minute. But this is the Gentleman Crocodile, another Japanese katakuri puzzle. And this one is actually kind of odd because it's like you see it wearing a hat, but really it's all you got to do is pull the tail and then open up and there's a little duck in there that he...
I found out an interesting fact
because I said, oh, he's eating the duck, right? But a bunch of people said that, and if you pull this, then it opens up the secret door there. But a bunch of people said that apparently crocodiles have a symbiotic relationship with birds. Well, they'll keep their mouth open, and the birds will come and pick the food out of their teeth so that the teeth don't rot or something like that. And I said, I did not know that. But I bet you every once in a while, those birds that think they're helping them out...
just lose their life in the process, but
anyhow, I just thought this is one of those puzzles that's super easy, but it looks pretty cool.
So what's easy? How long would it take you to solve that?
Oh, that would take a minute.
And then do you go back and redo them later?
It depends on the puzzle.
Kind of piece of art on the.
It's mostly, it becomes a piece of art, but this one in particular, this Barabara box, actually is really fun to solve. Maybe after the podcast, I'll let you go ahead and solve, but it's really fun. So certain puzzles are ones that you want to solve over. It's kind of like a book, some books you want to read over and over.
Sometimes you want to read one and watch it again.
Okay. Yeah, and it doesn't mean it's a bad movie just because you don't want to watch it. It might be too heavy or just, you know, whatever. You know.
Or just bad.
And there's some really fluffy ones that you'll watch over and over because it just makes you, it's like junk food for the brain.
Agreed.
You know, so it's just one of those things.
Okay, nice.
But moving on to the topic at hand, we wanted to talk today about the skin barrier. And so, I forgot to mention the Peanut Gallery. We have Dr. Jose Maldonado and Dashe Kumungu. And then Alan, the producer-director, sans his better half, Seti, who's in Germany right now. But is it still okay to say that about somebody's spouse, their better half? Or is insulting?
For sure. Yeah. For sure.
Okay. Because, no. I don't know. Today, it seems like people are a little more delicate, you know, so... but anyway,
she's definitely my better half.
If he says it, I think it's okay.
Okay. All right. So anyhow, today Jose brought to our attention the skin barrier and he thought it'd be good to talk about. I think mostly because it's the winter months. It's where a lot of people get the itching and the drying and the cracking. Right. And I think that there's, in America especially, in the United States, but in Western culture in general, we have kind of an epidemic of overwashing. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people try to remedy that by adding a lot of moisturizers and then there's so many moisturizers that have so many ingredients, some that are probably good emollients and good humectants and good moisturizers, others that they try to get too fancy and it ends up kind of doing the opposite.
Right.
And so that's what I would like to start talking about today. And then I'd like to get in a little bit of the skin microbiome in there. But, that's I have to do that.
Really? Fascinating.
But first, let's start with just the general. Why don't you just educate us for the consumer?
Sure.
What makes up the skin barrier? Because we hear that in a nebulous way. But I don't think a lot of people really appreciate what makes up a skin barrier and how it can be so delicate.
Sure. So not to dumb it down, but I'm going to dumb it down just a little bit for you. So we've got three main layers of the skin, the epidermis, which we think of as the skin, the dermis, which is below where all the blood vessels and things are, and then you get into the subcutaneous fat that's underneath that.
Which is important.
Yes, it is. They're all important.
We don't want to suck all of the fat out. We need fat.
The top layer of the skin is called the stratum corneum, and it's made of cornified, which are essentially dead keratinocytes, but you think of it in your mind like a brick wall. And so those skin cells are sitting there, but there's mortar in between those cells that's making up a barrier there. Mm-hmm. And so that mortar is made up of cholesterol, free fatty acids, and ceramides are the primary ingredients there that are sticking all those corneocytes together. You shed them as we age, and sometimes this time of year in the winter months, you see it as you pull off your jeans and you shed all over the bathroom. And
Wow. You guys must be drier than I am.
Your house. The snowstorm, I guess I see it, doing skin checks on old guys every day, everything. It's just skin cells flying everywhere. Those are those corneocytes that you're seeing there. And when your barrier's impaired and mm-hmm. it's too dry, that's when you've got that snowstorm. And so a healthy barrier, you've got that intact brick wall, essentially, with that ceramides, free fatty acids, and cholesterol between the cells in that top layer or that barrier of your skin.
Right. And so let's talk about so you have the oily mm-hmm. layer, which is what you were talking about, ceramides, phospholipids, phospholipids, all these things. And then you have these mummified, mm-hmm. is the way I kind of think, or leathered kind of layer here. But if that is our barrier, which is what you're saying, why is it that Americans are so obsessed with exfoliation?
So, exfoliation is a tough one. It's just that we have this obsession, I think, in the United States about being overly clean. It's the same kind of thing that we see higher incidences of some different disease processes in the developed countries because we're not being as exposed to these other microbial exposures over the time. But in our American culture, we really do, most of us like to be clean. We like to smell good, all of those kind of things. It's mm-hmm. just a kind of a cultural expectation, not just in the States, but in, most developed countries, you see a bit more of that obsession.
But why do we equate that as clean? Because I could see, for instance, I never exfoliate. Mm-hmm. Do I come across as dirty? I mean,
I've been meaning to talk
to you. Okay, you be quiet. no, but seriously, it's like, I see certain people, for instance, who is the physician that wrote the book Clean? I'm trying to remember his name. I should remember it. But anyway, he is the one that didn't shower for 5 years. I think he's a dermatologist. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't advocate for that.
Me either.
I think that's a little bit extreme.
Right.
I think he did it for a point, though.
But it's the same thing that I see patients all the time that come in and they're rubbing their face with rubbing alcohol. Or they're using Noxzema. Or they're mm-hmm. using Clear. So when they don't need it, but you feel that tightness and you think, oh my gosh, I must be clean. Yeah. And so
The tightness. What is that?
So you've stripped your barrier lipids is what that is. And so you no longer have that moisture in your skin, and therefore it feels tight and dry because you don't have that natural moisture. You stripped those oils out of your skin. That's what traditional soaps are, especially, you've got this thing that we call the acid mantle in mm-hmm. your skin as well. And you know that very mm-hmm. well because it's involved. You want the right pH, clearly, to support the right skin environment, both mm-hmm. the microbiome and all the other things that we're talking about here. Surfactants are designed to get dirt balled up, but what happens is you pull out the other stuff with it.
And the oil.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so especially the more alkaline it is, the more you're damaging that skin barrier when you're doing that. So lye soap would be the extreme example of that. But a lot of our traditional soaps do the same thing between surfactants and having an overly alkaline pH.
Right. And I think that's one of the things Americans really are ignorant towards. I don't know if that's not a very nice word, but it's kind of an accurate word. And it's not their fault because we don't all go to school to learn chemistry about how to read an inky label on the back of a soap bottle. Right. And unfortunately, it's not just the ingredients, it's also the levels, right? Mm-hmm. And they don't have to be disclosed because it's not the FDA, whoever mandates cosmetic stuff, you don't have to disclose levels. And so they could have a lot of surfactants in there because one of the things that Americans have been kind of conditioned is that if it lathers, it means it's cleaning better. Right. And I actually don't use anything that lathers. I mean, I take that back. Shampoos is hard not to find. I'm sure there are some probably good ones out there, but being a man that doesn't have a really long hair, I don't have to worry about stripping my hair of moisture. My scalp, yes, I don't lather my scalp, just the hair to get the products out. But I stay away from other lathering products because of that very thing. What's your thought on how should the consumer be choosing the products which they use to cleanse themselves, and how often should they be cleansing themselves? Because it's different for people that do wear makeup or don't wear makeup. And so what is your kind of philosophy there?
So in the impaired skin barrier, there was this hypothesis for a long time that you should be bathing less as opposed to more. Now, overbathing is really not a problem, but I try to educate, especially like my parents of children who have atopic dermatitis or eczema, that it's not so much that you can't bathe, it's how you bathe and what you're using when you bathe. And so we've got great surfactant-free eczema cleansers that are easy to find over the counter. Good old Dove soap is one that I recommend, especially because it's easy to access for most of my older patients.
Is that
especially
all the brand, or is there specific within Dove?
Just the good old classic fragrance-free. Like, okay. Dove soap is one that...
Fragrance-free is a key one.
Yes, fragrance-free. But
and is that a bar or liquid?
You can do both.
Either one. Available. Okay.
But, I mean, a lot of times I practice in a rural market, and patients are very, very cost conscious, and that tends to be one that's very cost accessible for patients. And so, but using gentle fragrance-free cleansers, and then when you get out of the bath, that's when you should apply, my preference is a good ceramide-containing moisturizer. Number one, you need less of it if that skin's still moist through there. You're trapping that moisture in, and if you'll do that, guys, I get complaints all the time. They're like, I feel greasy if I'm putting all that lotion on. But if you'll do it kind of right then, it's kind of a double benefit. You're trapping some of that moisture in because it's that evaporation of water. It's the same thing we see in hand dermatitis when people have such a hard time with alcohol hand sanitizers or over hand washing. It's that constant evaporation as well that's impairing and stripping those natural lipids out of that kind of skin barrier layer.
And let's talk about the hand washing, because that's one that's more prevalent now than it was 3 years
ago. For sure.
And I think that comes down to, again, for it was a fear thing. People just don't, you know, it's one of those, let's err on the side of safety versus, you know, comfort type of things. And I think even now, some people are still caught in the habit of overwashing or using too much hand sanitizer. And I am of the ilk of, if you have a strong immune system, unless you have a reason to believe that you've touched something, it's really not probably necessary to overwash or to habitually wash. What's your feeling on that? I mean, you probably wash more often than most.
I wash my hands at least 50 times a day, but I try to use an antibiotic foam as opposed to, because it's got some hydrating properties to it. And I also use some hand creams that have some barriers in them as well, just to protect, you know, and I do that habitually because I do wash my hands all the time. I have to.
I'm doing skin checks, surgeries,
and those kind of things as well. But for my patients, especially patients with hand dermatitis, what you just said, if your hands are soiled, wash your hands.
Right.
But I encourage them to keep next to the sinks where they traditionally wash their hands a ceramide or a barrier containing, you know, emollient right after you've washed, if you needed to, get that moisturizer on your hands right afterwards and protect that skin. Because if I can change behavior in hand dermatitis, that's much more effective than me handing you a tube of a steroid cream.
100%. And steroid creams do not come with no ramifications.
Right,
there
absolutely.
Are things that happen. I think that's what most people don't get, is that medications, they come with a bit of a cost sometimes. And then you have to take another medication to get rid of that.
Absolutely.
And so really medications are meant for helping when you have something that you can't solve by other means. Mm-hmm. Where as Americans, I think we're kind of conditioned to go to medications first and not address the underlying cause.
Right.
And so I think that's an important distinction, what you just said. But when it comes to things like moisturizers, soaps we talked about, but moisturizers, there's a lot out there, right? Mm-hmm. And they all have a lot of the marketing spin that come. What's your recommendation for what is going to be healthiest for people that have barrier issues?
So we talk about transepidermal water loss, and that's a measure that we use in a lot of cosmetic clinical trials and medical clinical trials. And so the gold standard is what we were talking about in the last podcast, Vaseline, Aquaphor. I mean, they let very
Tell me
little,
about that. I want to hear about this, because there are people that are doing what's called slugging. Are you familiar with that term?
Oh, I don't like it, whatever
tell
it
me.
Is.
Okay.
Slugging.
Well, let me tell you what it is. And this is my understanding, because I don't do this, but it's kind of I guess it's a social media type
of
thing.
It's like a TikTok thing.
I don't know if it's TikTok, but I know I know dermatologists that are doing it and they endorse it, which is the idea is that if you have an active that you want to get into your skin, let's say a retinoid or an niacinamide, by putting that on and then putting Vaseline, something occlusive like a Vaseline, and leaving it on like gloppy, then it's going to force the active to go in because you've now occluded it. So we know that things like lidocaine, when you're doing topical lidocaine, we've done that with Saran Wrap and stuff. Is that something that's helpful? I mean, I look at that, I'm like, I'm not sure occluding is the best thing for, because then really, it teaches your skin to not produce oil, right?
It does. And so over-moisturizing sometimes can be a problem as well in the wrong skin types. But I do encourage my patients after using active ingredients to moisturize in some form or fashion, again, because I've got active ingredients there, but I want to maintain a healthy skin barrier also. Right. And so that last step, so in folks who have dry skin, I love an Aquaphor or Vaseline if you can, but sometimes that's too greasy for some folks, or they don't like it on their hands because they're touching things and leaving oil spots.
Or it gets on
their
pillow or something.
Right. Yeah. So you take a step down that transepidermal water loss into creams, and then a step farther down gets into lotions. And that's really how much of that water loss or how much we're protecting, because that barrier is doing two things. It's protecting you from the outside pathogens, but you're also sealing in those moistures. And so it's doing both of those things, and that's what we're trying to get it to do. Now, like applying a jar of Aquaphor or Vaseline, if that's the trend, I don't know that I'm doing
that. I don't know if it's a little jar, but it's definitely pretty occlusive. But what should they look for? Is there any particular attributes of a moisturizer? Like for me, you mentioned before, like I avoid fragrances like the plague, not because all fragrances are bad, but because they're not disclosing what the fragrances are, and some of them are bad. And so they're unnecessary, in my opinion. So I just say, I just don't even need them. So let's not even take a chance. Mm-hmm. Are there things that you look for or look to avoid?
So I like ceramides in any good moisturizer. Like I said, that's one of the primary components through there. Sometimes in certain skin conditions, I'm also encouraging humectants or alpha hydroxy acid. So lactic acid, salicylic acids, those really help sometimes when folks have an impaired barrier as well, because you're pulling some moisture in too from beneath as well as applying a barrier on top. You know, for folks who have contact dermatitis, which is something that I see very frequently as a dermatologist, we try to stay more gentle. Again, people say, I want something that's totally natural. I'm like, sweet, poison ivy is totally natural, and I don't want you rubbing it on your skin. So that's where I see a lot of folks get into trouble, is that they say, I want these natural, but they're over applying fragrances or essential oils at a concentration that's harmful to the skin barrier.
Concentration's also very important, right?
And so, you know, that's harming the skin barrier as opposed to improving it.
Yeah, you know, you're bringing up all sorts of pearls of wisdom, and that I've mentioned many times. Concentration is one of the things that I think most people just, it completely goes over their head, because they just look for ingredients. But concentration is important in medicine.
Hugely so.
And in skin, even the makeup of the fats, concentration is important for a proper barrier. And that's why, for me, I think it's so confusing for consumers. Well, Angela, what do you think about this? Because for me as a consumer myself, I have a little more knowledge when it comes to skincare. So I look for things. I can actually find things. I can actually have my R&D group make them specifically for me. But unfortunately, not everybody has that ability. And what do they do? Because there's not the transparency that you need.
I think they're not looking at ingredients. They're looking at the way something feels and the way it smells, first and foremost. I don't think the average consumer has the education to turn the bottle around and understand what they're reading, or the impact of 50 ingredients versus five, or what that means essentially. So, you know, so you keep saying ceramides. That would be one ingredient that they could keep an eye out for, right? When they turn the label around and understand that typically, not always, but in the industry, the higher the percentage, the higher it's going to be in the labeling. If it's in the product over 1%, anything under 1% can be mixed up on the back of the label.
So write that down, everybody, because that's good to know, but not everybody knows that.
Not everybody knows that. So, you know, probably understanding from a skin expert, what exactly am I looking for beyond scent and feel of something? And then I'll go back to the earlier conversation in terms of exfoliating. What we hear from some of our other guests of the podcast is, in the dermatology field, is what patients are looking for is a glow. So they're exfoliating or doing things to help get the glow to the skin. Are you seeing that on the cosmetic side of your practice?
Absolutely.
Is that a word that they're that they're using
glow
and asking for?
Always use. I mean, we're trying to seek that glow with procedures that we're doing, with products that we're using, with makeups that we're using as well. Where I encourage my folks is to exfoliate less, and when they're using exfoliants, if they have a healthy skin barrier, you shouldn't be able to see the grains or the beads in that exfoliation. Mm-hmm. So like there's some classic ones that have like almond shells and that kind of stuff over the counter, or people making their own, they are tearing themselves up through there. So
that, you know, that brings with, we're talking about skin barrier. Is there something they can do in particular in terms of topically or other means that would be less harmful to the skin that can give them the glow, but yet preserve the skin barrier? So you mentioned,
and this is a normal individual?
Procedural.
Both.
So procedurally, I mean, microneedling is my favorite to give folks a glow.
Guess what?
Because you've induced that healing
you
cascade.
You don't say.
I know.
So, I really did. I wasn't fishing. I was
genuinely.
But it
when
is true.
Folks come in and that's the one specific thing that they're asking for, I tend to steer them towards microneedling as opposed to laser and light-based devices, where I really want to use those when I'm looking more at pigment or vascular changes, those kind of things. But when they come in specifically saying that glow, that's really one of my favorite. And then doing a good routine that includes an antioxidant and typically moisturizers as well. I see folks sometimes with oilier skin that say, I'm never going to put any moisturizer on. I need to put products like rubbing alcohol or overuse of retinoids.
That's going to make you more oily.
Exactly. And so you get this reverse effect. You get more sebaceous hyperplasia or overgrown oil glands. And so that's a problem that I see too, is when folks are trying to dry their skin out, you're going to actually dull it out as well.
Yeah, you know, that's it's again one of the things that most consumers don't realize is that even in skin, every action has an equal and opposite reaction, and the body has systems in place to have what's called homeostasis, where now it can be off, meaning we may be genetically predisposed to have something a little bit out of balance, and that's where you go to your dermatologist, and the dermatologist can tell you maybe you have this genetic predisposition. One is an eczema. There are some mutations that in the filaggrin gene that can actually cause us to have a little bit of an imbalance in the skin barrier, which can lead to more predisposition, but not necessarily cause eczema, but predisposition. And that's where things like over-cleansing and such can then enter into the picture. We've only got a couple minutes left, but I want to bring in the microbiome to this picture, because one of the things that I'm really passionate about is that we as a society, as you mentioned, our over clean type of mentality, we tend to blame bacteria and microbes and fungus for disease. But what we don't think about is that we may be actually habitually preparing our skin to house certain bacteria.
Right.
So for instance, if we're over cleansing the skin and we're getting rid of all the oils, which is the main food source for C. acnes, which is the most abundant bacteria on the skin, which produces propionic acid, which lowers the pH of the skin, which keeps Staphylococcus away, could it be that over-cleansing the skin is producing an environment that's hospitable to Staphylococcus?
Absolutely. I mean, I see an increased incidence of staphylococcal infections in my folks with atopic dermatitis. I mean, you can physically see skin that's been stripped. You know, it doesn't look healthy. It doesn't take a dermatologist to say, hey, your skin doesn't look healthy. And so it makes sense that you set up an environment for pathogens to set up house.
And so really the first step to that is, like you said, are you cleansing too much?
Right.
Let's briefly talk about the bleach baths.
Yeah.
So people in the past have said to use bleach baths because of the aseptic nature of bleach baths. But again, that's a presupposition that that's the cause of the disease rather than a symptom, because we've created a bad environment.
Right.
And when we bleach our skin, are we really rectifying the environment?
So stepping back to bleach baths and how I've always talked to my patients about bleach baths, because when I trained, I've been out of residency for 15 years now. I actually didn't talk about it as stripping your skin or making it aseptic, but sometimes we do see, because you have this pathogenic environment secondary to the atopic dermatitis, you have an overcolonization of staph. Mm-hmm. And so sodium hypochlorite or bleach was thought in a way to, without creating bacterial resistance, which is also a huge problem in our westernized society, without creating bacterial resistance, we were both decreasing the biofilm and we were decreasing colonization of staphylococcal bacteria. And so I don't disagree with the way my brain was thinking about things back then, because I wasn't thinking about being aseptic, But interestingly, I'm not really sure the dilutions that we were using were any more effective than taking a good bath and moisturizing your skin afterwards.
Which is what the
papers, yeah, and meta-analyses have gone back and said. Because what I was telling patients to do was in 3 inches of water to do a quarter cup of bleach. And so very, very, very hypodilute. And I would never want anyone listening to this podcast to think it's ever okay to place undilute bleach.
Oh, no. Or, you'll burn your skin. You know,
yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's terrible to do. But it's not really something that I use as my first line education like I did 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, again, when you know better, you can do better. Right. We're learning every day about, and now that we have metagenomics and we're looking at the microbiome and the skin biome in general, we're learning that possibly we can find the roots, which are not necessarily blaming. For instance, Staph aureus is on a lot of people's skin.
Right.
It's just when you have a hospitable environment for it to kind of overgrow. Mm-hmm. So what if we reduce the pH? What if we reintroduce more diversity into that area? And we're starting to see, even in our own clinic, I don't want to, you know, divulge too much of what we're studying right now, but we're seeing that when we do that, we can actually get rid of things like eczema and psoriasis.
Right.
You know, this is very exciting for us because we're actually proving a shift in the paradigm of, rather than blaming the microbe, we're now saying, well, maybe we are, our habits need some adjustment.
And this is where the first time you and I talked, I got super, super nerd out excited. And that's because, like, what I'm treating in dermatology with all of my biologic medications are these inflammatory cascades that are, you know, from these genetic transcription factors. But what if, without just treating that symptom of these inflammation by adjusting the skin's microbiome, our bodies do it themselves? That it's 100%. Not necessarily like, oh, we don't need to treat those inflammatory cascades. We need to prevent those inflammatory cascades 100%. From happening.
Yeah. What is the saying? An ounce of
prevention is worth a pound of cure. Yeah.
And that's the whole crux of the matter, is that rather than going first towards these biologics, which I'm sure they're great if you need them.
Which are life-changing for my patients. If you need them. Please don't hear me not say that. But so, can I be an adjunct to where perhaps I'm using them less, or I've got patients that are less severe and maybe I don't need all these medications.
And maybe we start them when they need them severely and then we wean them off.
Right.
There's a lot of ways to look at it rather than just addicting somebody to something for life unnecessarily. And so that's where it gets exciting. We're not trying to say to anybody your product sucks or you're doing it the wrong way. What we're trying to say is we're learning new things. Maybe we need to rethink how we're doing things, because we're seeing some very real data. I'll tell you, I myself, even though, you know, I started the ball rolling on some of this research, there's times where I'm like, it's not going to work for that. And then all of a sudden I'm like, wow, it worked.
Yeah.
And the onion just keeps getting peeled. The world of the skin biome is so fascinating. And I cannot wait till the day where we can actually go through some. I mean, I shared with you some of the data from the BioJuve line, which I'd love to have you back someday to just discuss that. But, you know, just that's exciting, but there's layers and layers beyond that that we're exploring that is so exciting that I just simply am so proud of the work we're doing, because I believe it is changing some of the way that we look at skin disease. And so I think that's all we have time for. Is there anything else that you want to talk about with the skin barrier?
I think this is a great topic, that protecting our skin barrier, it's just overly important, both in pathogenic processes like eczema, but for all of us every day.
Health and beauty.
Yes, absolutely.
Angela, what about you?
I would just say, for, you know, the average consumer, is understanding that skin science is progressing just like any other science.
Yeah.
And we're learning more and more every day, and to be open to that knowledge, receiving that knowledge, to be asking the question. This is a skin science podcast, to be aware of what the science is telling us, and don't think that something that we did, you know, 20 years ago is necessarily what we're going to be doing next year, and be open to the progression of the science. And, you know, our dermatologists are the best sources for that science. So see your dermatologist.
Yeah, and read books from skin scientists.
Yes, there's one that's coming out that I'm really excited about. I can't remember the name, but...
Well, actually, let me float something past you. So I looked this up, and I don't think it's a thing, but I think I'm going to coin it. And so I actually call myself a holobiontologist now, which I don't believe is a thing.
Holobiontologist.
Holobiontologist.
Holobiontologist. Can you get a t-shirt?
I think so. And so I want to make that a thing where you're actually getting degrees in holobiontology.
Which I think is great, because everything you've talked about, it is treating the whole self. It is treating the whole process. Because like you say, as we're talking about, I get excited thinking about the pathologies that I treat. Can we do a better job holistically treating this patient, to where what I have to do as a medical intervention, we take those burdens down, down the road, the side effects my patients are seeing. Mm-hmm. I'm all about holobiontology. Mm-hmm.
All right.
I'll get the first
t-shirt,
too.
T-shirt sold.
Okay, I got to get that trademarked immediately.
Yes.
All right, Jose, anything you want to share to wrap this up?
No, just another, can you just give another PSA to go see your doctors and how science is advancing? I have a skin condition, psoriasis, and for the most part, I had made my mind that it's something that I'm going to have to just live with. But I'm trying something brand new here at Crown. I don't know if I could talk about it too much, nope. But for the first time, I'm so excited about my skin. So go see your skin doctors. That's go great. See your dermatologist.
Yeah, we can talk about it afterwards when there's not being recorded. But anyway, all right, thank you so much. And so, Jenny, Dr. Holman, where can they find you if they want to learn more about you and what you do?
So if you want some silly cosmetic videos, because that's mainly what we do is cosmetic education and product education, it's calm.tyler on Instagram.
Okay, and Angela, how about you?
Angela Wilson McDonald, and don't be overwhelmed with all the content there. You know, you might spend hours, you know, reviewing all of the content.
I would like everybody that watches this to go to Angela's Instagram and leave a like and a message to encourage her
to do more.
Well, just because I think she feels like overwhelmed with trying to get it started. So I think we need to give her some love and encouragement.
I'm about to pay someone to do it for me. That's what I'm about to do.
Never mind. Do not go to her Instagram. I'm just kidding.
Samantha, I'll be calling.
All right. So also you can go to crownlaboratories.com and go to the medical affairs section to see all the collateral we do, Beauty and the Bacteria, the Skin Science Podcast, and an array of articles and such that we put together on skin science as we are Skin Science for Life. Again, I'm Dr. Thomas Hitchcock. You can find me at dr.t.hitchcock on Instagram or go to my website at DocHitchcock.com if you want to see some of the articles I write, videos that we make, and if you want to see some of the puzzles that I solve. Thank you for your eyes and ears. We hope that you glean something from this conversation. And until next time, goodbye for now.